Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat. Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm Manoj Keval Ramani, and today I have with me Aditya and Anirudh, and we're going to be talking about the Middle East. Well, today the Middle East is extremely turbulent, but do you believe that there was a time when it was actually in some ways peaceful? There was a certain balance of power with two mega states dominating the region. We're going to be talking about all of that, but before we get into all of that, let's just take a quick commercial break. Welcome back. So like I said before the break, we're going to be talking about the Middle East, and we're going to be talking about the history of the Middle East as opposed to the current turbulent times. I mean, for most of us remembering history of the Middle East, it's modern day history where we can't think of a time where things have been peaceful. It's always been deeply chaotic. It's a 2014 paper by Michael Cook from Princeton University. The paper is called The Long-Term Geopolitics of the Pre-Modern Middle East. And he looks at a span of 1500 years, if I'm correct. And he looks at essentially how and why is it that the region that we call the Middle East was dominated by mega states a long time ago, and why that is no longer the case. It's a much more fragmented area. And apart from sort of European colonialism, there are other reasons. So Anirudh, just tell us, what's the argument that he's making in this paper?
So I think all of our listeners might be familiar with the usual American disclaimers that they use before they invade the Middle East, right? They're always like, oh, these people have been killing each other for centuries. It doesn't make any difference if we add a little more to the fray. But that's actually an exception if you look at the overall trajectory of the Middle East. And most interesting to me is the fact that very often the Middle East problems, the Middle East politics are put down to things that happened in the post-colonial era. But that's not necessarily the case. The Middle East has a long and very, very interesting history. It's not only the seat of the earliest civilizations, but also for most of human history, the seat of its superpowers. When I say superpowers, obviously the very first superpower that we know of in history is the Persian Empire. And what the gentleman's argument is that there's something about the geopolitics, the resources and the fertility, the availability of various things in this region that makes it ideally suited for the emergence of empires. To give you an example, this is not something that's talked about in the paper, but the paper actually starts in 600 AD or so, but let's try to step back and look at it from 600 BC. Now, 600 BC, you'd already seen the rise and fall of many great empires in Mesopotamia, the land between the two rivers, also known now as Iraq. And what you see around 600 is that this ambitious young Persian lord manages to conquer most of the highlands of Persia and then invades Iraq. And this lays the foundation for an empire that in one form or another lasts, or I think a geopolitical formation is really a better way to term it than an empire. It lays the foundation for a geopolitical formation that lasts till well into the 1700s. Mm-hmm. And the reason for this is that Mesopotamia, since it's where the Bronze Age civilizations begin, has centuries of agrarian practice. You've had settled agriculture, cities, sedentary populations, extensive irrigation works, which makes it a very, very fertile, agriculturally productive area. And also because you have people who are settled there, who are used to receiving your annual visits from the tax collectors, it's basically a very, very fertile ground for a pre-modern state to get its revenues from. But revenues alone aren't enough, of course, if you want to maintain your control over such a wide area. And this chap, Cyrus the Great, the founder of the Persian Empire, at its peak, this Persian Empire spread from parts of Greece and Egypt all the way to Punjab and Sindh. So how do you maintain control over such a wide area? It's not just enough to be really, really rich through tax collection of crops and so on and so forth. You need to be able to use force, which means you need to have armies. And the way that the Persian Empire did it was to source most of its military manpower from the highlands of Iran. So the way that the author of the paper describes it is that the stability of the great superpowers in the Middle East is down to the synergy, essentially, of the tax power of Iraq and the manpower of Iran.
All right. And this sustains for a significant period of time before it sort of changes. So why does this change? What exactly happens here?
So obviously, Iran or Persia is not the only major center of imperium in the Middle East. There's also the Anatolian Peninsula. This was the heart of the Eastern Roman Empire and what we later call the Byzantine Empire. How did they interact with Persia?
So the way that we should think about this is basically as heartlands capable of sustaining empires, right? Now, Anatolia is one heartland and Greece is one heartland. So if you look at the Eastern Roman Empire, these guys are, again, a very, very successful polity. The capital is actually moved to modern-day Istanbul, then called Constantinople, in the 4th century. And that is finally only taken over by the Ottomans in the 15th century. So over the course of 1,000 years, you have a single state controlling that region.
If you want lessons in political longevity, check out the Byzantines.
Absolutely. I honestly think the Byzantines are among the most fascinating polities of the medieval period. And I say this as a medieval Deccan nerd. Those guys are fascinating. But let me not get into them right now. I want to make a more general case about the stability of this Byzantine imperial formation, right? Is it something very similar to what's happening in Iran? The same underlying factors seem to underpin the success of both these long-lasting geopolitical formations. And that is to have basically a synergy of agriculturally productive lands and lands that you can use to just get manpower. Now, think about this. If you have this widely spread out mountainous area like the Iranian plateau or a very hilly and relatively dry region like inland Anatolia, it's very difficult for you to send tax collectors there. On the other hand, if you were to set up military lords and say, okay, we won't tax you at all, provided that you provide us with a certain number of troops, all of a sudden you turn into a massive powerhouse of manpower. And this happens both with the Byzantines looking at Anatolia and the Persian emperors looking at Iran, which is quite interesting. These guys come from Iran, they set up their capital in Iraq, and they always rule from there. And it remains the seat of Persian power essentially till the 7th century, which is when everything changes.
So what exactly happens in the 7th century? From what I understand, there is a war between two fairly ambitious individuals, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So there's an interesting political backstory to all this. So what happens is that there's a coup. The Byzantine emperor is kicked off his throne and replaced with somebody else who abrogates all the treaties that the Byzantines had with the Persians. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the deposed emperor's son then flees to Persia and requests that the emperor honor the treaty of friendship that his father signed with him. Mm-hmm. Now, this was nothing near that degree of friendship. What essentially it was a non-interference agreement that they will have certain spheres of influence. But this Persian emperor is an ambitious character and he sees a chance to have the Roman emperor himself beholden to him. So he invades Anatolia, and because of a number of different factors, this is the weakest that the Romans have been in centuries. So it's devastatingly successful. You literally have Persian armies that pierce all the way through Anatolia and are almost at the gates of Constantinople, the furthest that they've been since basically the period of the Greek city-state centuries ago. But somehow, the Romans actually managed to fight back. It's ridiculous. We actually have stories of how the Patriarch of Constantinople, who today is basically just a figurehead, actually paraded icons of Christ and the Virgin Mary on the walls of the city and roused up the entire population to this fanatical state of like resisting all enemies that came. The church actually got together and literally melted down their gold, their tapestries and so on and so forth, gave them to the state to help them raise money. And then the Romans actually pushed back. And this is, I think, the Roman Emperor Heraclius,
yes,
one of the few Roman emperors known to have actually led his armies from the front lines.
Mm-hmm.
So he leads an invasion that goes deep into the heart of Iraq. We have some instances supposedly of Persian officers praising him and saying to the Romans that, look at your emperor, how fearlessly he runs before our javelins.
Mm-hmm.
So this man clearly would just put himself into danger to rally his troops and get them to fight against a very feared enemy. And he's very successful. He managed to defeat the Persian emperor, defeats many major Persian armies, actually sacks the capital. And it seems that, you know, there's absolute victory, and at long last, the Middle East can return to peace and the Romans and Persians can go about their business again.
Yeah, and this is obviously a really fascinating conflict. And at the end of it, both these powers are fairly weak.
Hmm.
And there's a plague.
Yes.
And then something really strange happens.
Yes.
Which kind of changes the world a little bit.
Just a little bit. Just a tiny little bit. Some man called Muhammad hears the words of the Archangel Gabriel in some little town somewhere in Arabia. And all of a sudden, the entire history of the world changes. the Arabs. And just think about this, one of the great black swan events of history. Neither side could have predicted something like this was going to happen, that you would have this extraordinarily charismatic military leader from basically a desert backwater that neither empire really cared about, somehow rallying a large population of tribal people who are used to this kind of internecine raiding warfare and who are thus very, very good at hit and run attacks, which also works wonderfully against the very large, immobile, relatively immobile armies of the Romans and Persians. And within the course of a century, the entirety of Syria, Egypt, Iraq, and Iran are taken over by this new polity, the Caliphate. So in the early centuries of the Caliphate, their primary antagonist, or since the Persians are not really on the picture, are the Romans. So the early Caliphate, the Umayyads, maintained a very sizable military presence on the border with Anatolia, with the Eastern Roman Empire. And they were also engaged in a lot of adventures across the world. Incidentally, the Umayyads invaded India in the 8th century. This is not something a lot of people know about. They didn't just invade Sindh, but actually got into the Deccan itself, and they were defeated somewhere in southern Gujarat, which is fascinating. Their military forces were basically concentrated, the Arabs were concentrated along the border with the Roman Empire, but there was also a very considerable body of Iranian troops that had become part of the Arab armies and who were generally posted in the Khorasan area, which is in northeastern Iran. And these guys were basically constantly fighting off Central Asian hordes, but weren't really getting a lot of attention from the center. The capital of the Umayyad Caliphate was in Damascus. Great city, but not really a very great place if you aren't an Arab Muslim. So even though you had Middle Easterners, Mediterranean, Levantine people who were converting to Islam, they weren't necessarily treated the same way as Arab Muslims were. And especially Iranians who had converted to Islam, who were fighting for the cause of the Caliphate against various enemies across all parts of the world, felt that they were kind of getting the short end of the stick. So what they do is they kind of collude with a gentleman who's descended from the Muhammad's uncle, Abbas. And the deal that Abbas cuts with them is that basically, look, the Caliphate, the Ummah, must be led by somebody who's related to the Prophet himself. And the Ummah is for all Muslims, not just for the Arab Muslims. So we will treat Iranians the same way we treat Arabs. You'll get an equal share of the booty, which is a really great political arrangement. And soon the Umayyad Caliphate is overthrown and a new caliphate is installed, the Abbasids. Now, the Abbasids, keep in mind, they've made this promise to the Iranians that they're going to make them more dominant in their empire. And that's this promise they actually managed to keep. And what do you see? The Abbasids, who are ruling in Baghdad in Iraq, who control the tax power of Iraq, have now managed to bring the manpower of Iran into their political formation. And for the next 200 years, the Abbasid Caliphate is extraordinarily successful. It becomes a global superpower because it's connected these very agriculturally fertile regions, because it created new urban centers, because it has all this plunder and loot, this new infusion of capital into global trade networks. Actually trades quite extensively with India and with places as far away as China. So again, a true Middle Eastern superpower.
What I find interesting about when you start talking about the eventual sort of decline of the Abbasid Caliphate is that the role of, again, back then you think of conflict and wars and sort of empires changing because essentially another powerful empire has come around and that sort of, there's a conflict and therefore, you know, there's disintegration. And while some of those may be sort of important parts in this paper, Michael Cook essentially says that one of the underlying facts that's actually led to this downturn is the downturn of agriculture in Iraq. And that essentially is what is sort of fundamental to the disintegration. So again, the economy has always played an important role, continues to play an important role. And even back then, this arrangement starts to sort of wobble once agriculture starts to collapse, and then you enter a completely new different stage of fragmentation in the region, right?
Since you mentioned the fact that history is often seen as about the clash of great empires and great conquerors, this decline of agriculture in Iraq, which is something that really kicks in by the 9th, 10th centuries, is because the Abbasids are constantly killing each other off. Caliphs don't rule for very long. The state apparatus is really not interested in maintaining all this extensive irrigation works. And so they turn to like Turkic mercenary groups, tribes, and invite them to come and settle down in Iraq to act as the caliph's bodyguards. So these guys obviously don't really help the political situation. They just make it worse and worse. And because these guys are horse riding, sheep herding peoples who are spreading now across what used to be a primarily sedentary land, they're also fundamentally changing the willingness of the population to pay taxes, as well as the inclination and ability of the state to collect those taxes. So Iraq's ability to be the heartland of an empire is basically kind of denuded from both directions. And if you think about it, as Iraq fades from the geopolitical scene, Iran slowly starts to become more and more important. Specifically, the northeastern part of Iran, a region which I refer to as Khorasan, but which can also be, if we club it in with parts of Afghanistan, can also be called Ghazna. And that, of course, is where you see the earliest raids from this region actually coming into India at the time. So it's all tied together, right? The political activities of the Abbasids are connected to the decline of agriculture in Iraq, which is connected to the decline of political authority in Iran, which in turn is connected to the invasions of India. Because keep in mind, these are basically very militaristic peoples who now no longer have the kind of agrarian tax base they need to support states. So what they have to do instead is raid India.
Yeah, go to newer places which are fertile where you can actually get some of these options.
Exactly. And it's not a coincidence that the first thing they go for is to go and set up a base in Punjab, right?
Yeah.
Because A, you want control of that fertile land, and it's also a great kind of beachhead for invasions deeper into India.
Yeah, you know, when we talk about this marriage between military manpower and a tax base, basically a marriage between fiscal and military power, let's just reflect for a second on what that military manpower constitutes. A lot of these people really come from pastoral or semi-pastoral societies rather than fully settled societies. So you obviously have, you know, sometimes great infantry like the ancient Persian Empire's immortals, but you also have a great deal of cavalry. And some of this cavalry, this is, you know, the famous cataphract heavy cavalry. We also have horse archers. And these are the people who really help conquer lands and create these great empires. And something really interesting happens in Anatolia in the medieval period, which is that you have this new movement of a horse archer culture into that region, which is the Turkic peoples.
Yes.
And tell us how that changes Anatolia and how essentially helps create a resurgence there.
So I've talked about how Anatolia was governed during the Roman period, right? You basically had what are called themes, which are military governorships that are handed out among the great noble families of the realm. And these act as the powerhouse of the state. Now, when the Turks come into Iraq, because they're invited by the Abbasids, they obviously don't constrain their world by the boundaries of the caliphate. They're searching for opportunities elsewhere. And they happen to come across the Byzantines, who, as usual, are very, very distracted with internal politicking. And this is actually tied into like a bunch of other stuff connected to the Crusades and so on and so forth, but I'll not get into that. What happens when you bring the Turks into this settled system of military aristocracy, the settled system where you have clear manpower obligations to the state, is you're fundamentally changing how the Roman Empire raises troops. And you're all of a sudden replacing it with a much more mobile sort of force of nomadic peoples who respond to different kinds of incentives, who respond most importantly to success in battle. So if you look at the early Ottoman sultans, for example, they constantly describe themselves as ghazis, as warriors of the faith, which is also how Mahmud of Ghazni described himself, as a warrior of the faith, which acts as a really, really great way for you to motivate these tribal peoples, get them all behind the idea of, oh, let's go and loot some cities and let's spread ourselves out along this fertile grassland of Anatolia or Iran or wherever the case may be. What happens as a result is that this heartland of the Byzantine Empire is severed from them. And when in 1071 at the Battle of Manzikert, when the Seljuk Turks defeat the Byzantines, even though it's not the end of the Byzantine Empire, they continue for almost another half century. That's their end as a superpower, basically. Their influence in the Anatolian region is almost completely eradicated. It remains pockets of control along the coast, but the inland is all taken over by the Turks. And these guys eventually manage to emerge as the Ottomans, unite all the Turkish peoples behind them, and then cross over into Greece, and then finally reunite the same old Roman heartland. And it's very interesting to see how the Ottoman sultans then present themselves. All of a sudden, from Ghazis, they become Roman emperors. And it's fascinating. Suleiman the Magnificent, for example, one of the later Ottoman sultans. There's a very famous inscription of his. I'm not sure exactly where it is. I think it's either in Baghdad or in Mecca. And he says, when I am in Mecca, I am the caliph. When I am in Egypt, I am the sultan. When I am in Rome or Istanbul, I am the Kaiser. So he's describing himself as a Caesar. That's very much how they see themselves. And the Ottoman Empire is so fascinating to me because this, what they managed to do is kind of reunite the old heartlands of the Byzantine Empire. But the old heartlands of the Persian Empire have been more or less totally destroyed. The system of production, the people who are living there, the state structures, the urban centers are all totally modified by the coming and going of all these nomadic peoples. And as a result, the Iran-Iraq area is just no longer capable of sustaining true superpowers, which is why the Ottomans eventually managed to invade Iraq successfully and hold on to it till well into the World War period.
Let's just step back from the world wars and just go back to the late 18th century. By this time, you have two very significant things happening. One is, of course, those old cavalry armies are obsolete. At the famous Battle of the Pyramids, Napoleon's infantry wipes out this Egyptian cavalry. And it's also the time of the Industrial Revolution, which means that very soon, agriculture is not the main source of economic productivity.
Yep.
Now, how do these two factors fundamentally change the Middle East? Because you don't necessarily need to control as much land to have a fiscal base to raise, to create military power. Mm-hmm. And the forms of military power are also completely changing. That cavalry is no longer as important. How does that influence the trajectory of the Middle East thereafter?
One really great example that Michael Cook comes up with is to look at the trajectory of Egypt within this overall picture, right? You would assume that since Egypt is a river valley, it should also logically be the seat of a great empire. It was definitely a seat of many mighty empires during the Bronze Age. Why is it that in the medieval period, even though there are states in Egypt, these guys aren't really superpowers, right? The Mamluks and Fatimids are important, but they're not really superpowers. They can't compare with, say, the Abbasids at their peak. And his argument is that that's because of the nature of warfare, right? As you pointed out, it was mostly cavalry-centric. You cannot raise and breed and maintain good horses in Egypt. You can import them, but you're not going to get an awful lot of them. You can get like 20, 30,000, maybe you can maintain that much based on Egypt's agrarian productivity. But that's a very tiny army by the standards of the time. It's not really capable of projecting power elsewhere. It's capable of fighting very well defensively. In fact, the Mamluks who ruled Egypt did defeat the Mongols, who were a true superpower of the day, using a relatively small army. But things change, as you said, as we get closer to the Industrial Revolution. As cavalry basically starts to become more and more obsolete, as gunpowder weaponry becomes more and more efficient, as people start to figure out how to basically mass infantry together, infantry starts to dominate the battlefield in terms of sheer firepower. And then Egypt all of a sudden transforms into a superpower. So the Egyptians actually managed to modernize as the Industrial Revolution hits. They managed to create a very fertile agrarian base with modern irrigation systems. Their population booms and they're able to transform that population to a modern, very well-equipped army. And in fact, they kind of really turned the tables on the Ottomans, who historically had dominated Egypt. And an Egyptian army is actually stopped from entering the very heartland of Anatolia by the British. And I suspect that was one of the reasons why the British were so interested in taking over Egypt, because, of course, the sick man of Europe had to be kept alive.
Well, there's also the small matter of the Suez Canal. Let's just move to the beginning of the last century, a little over 100 years back. And what really changes is oil. You have first the discovery of oil in Persia, and then later on in the Arabian Gulf. We just talked about how after the explosion of Islam, the Arabian Gulf hasn't really been a major power center.
Yep.
But oil changes that. And you have in Saudi Arabia, a country that this time manages to marry oil, so fiscal power, with religious legitimacy, sacred geography, controlling the holy cities of Islam, and is able to basically become a power all out of proportion for its size. So that is, I think, something that's really fundamentally different in the Middle East today. The other is that while Iran doesn't have a Mesopotamia anymore, it sort of does have a Mesopotamia in its oil wells. And I think actually Iran is a bit of an underachiever. It really should be much more powerful in the Middle East than it really is.
It would be more powerful than it is if not for the fact that its economy is artificially constrained.
And if you look at the time of the Shah of Iran, It was much easier to believe that Iran would soon dominate the Middle East. But obviously, international isolation of this revolutionary regime has constrained its power. And its power has also been constrained by this new actor, which is Saudi Arabia, coming out of the Arabian Gulf. But having said all this, Iran does continue to project power into Mesopotamia and into what we call Khorasan. It has a great deal of influence in Afghanistan through proxies. It uses proxies in southern Iraq. So to some extent, the old patterns are reasserting themselves just in new forms.
See, these are all kind of similar. I mean, if you look at the way that the medieval Persians did geopolitics, they made it a habit of theirs to kind of encircle themselves with buffer states. The only place where they didn't manage to successfully do that was on the Roman frontier, which, as I mentioned, turned into a flashpoint at multiple times to their detriment. But it is quite interesting to see how Iran seems to broadly be continuing along the same strategic trajectory that it has over the last few hundred years.
Yeah, if you're an empire, you want mountains, you want seas, or you want client states. Iran actually has all three of them. It has essentially mountains and deserts on three sides, sea on a fourth side, and it's building up clients on its periphery.
I wanted to ask you guys one question that came up while I was reading this paper. In the conclusion, this is what he says, right? He talks about European involvement in the region. And he says, in the Middle East, apart from the creation of an independent state of Iraq, the effect of the European impact was not to create new fragmentation, but rather to preserve an already fragmented landscape. Now, we've spoken about the fact that the landscape was fragmented. But does this not underplay what the Europeans ended up doing in the region?
I
think it seriously underplays it, right?
Yeah, I do think it underplays the role of the Europeans. Once the Ottoman Empire had fallen, the British and the French were determined to carve up that corpse for themselves. It's not just about Iraq coming under the British. It's also about Syria. It's about the French carving out Lebanon, specifically in order to get a Maronite majority country facing the sea. You know, the British get Palestine, the Palestinian Mandate. I think they deliberately fragmented the region. Obviously, some of this could not have been anticipated. There was no master plan.
Yeah.
But the very nature of their imperial ambitions led to the fragmentation of the Middle East. I don't understand how that can be underplayed.
I think the Kurds would very, very strongly and emphatically disagree with what Mr. Cook is saying here.
Yeah, I mean, you just speaking about Iraq and the Kurds. Iraq has its current shape today precisely because the British needed a port, Basra, and they wanted it to be in the same political entity as where the oil is, inland.
Yeah.
So it's obviously created by imperial ambition.
So you basically overlay all this on top of centuries of kind of agrarian shift, populations moving around, and then the Middle East starts to make a little more sense.
Yeah, all this chaos starts to make sense as to why what's happening right now. It's not just about religion and identity. It's about a lot of history which goes in, which sort of links into the economy of the region and the way the region is structured and all of that.
And most interesting to me, it is also integrated with India's own history in so many ways. The Abbasids are tied into the emergence of India's trade networks. The Fatimids are tied into it. The Ghaznavids, the Delhi Sultans, the Mongol invasions. These are all things that India has gone through as well as the Middle East. And while we're used to thinking of the Middle East as composed of distinct geopolitical entities which have all these sometimes intersecting, sometimes interacting trajectories, we're not used to thinking of the Indian subcontinent the same way. There's a habit of thinking of how, oh yeah, Central Asians invaded India, but they kind of only invaded North India because that's where they wanted to be. And the rest of India kind of had its own story going on. The story of the Deccan is very different from the story of East India, for example. And all these complexities need to be understood. It's very easy to dismiss them because India is just a single nation state now. But once you start to look at them as discrete geopolitical regions and you understand how they relate to other geopolitical regions, the history of the entire world starts to make a lot more sense.
Yeah. You know, you can say what you will about the British Empire, but one of the effects it had as being a maritime power was that it actually closely linked India and the Middle East and, in a sense, strengthened the pre-existing traditional ties between those two regions. And it's really independence, partition, and other political and other politics that have actually sundered them, taken them apart. But actually, these are places that have been really deeply connected since time immemorial, since the Bronze Age.
I'm sure that our listeners have heard of the Khilafat movement. Why were Indian Muslims protesting about the removal of the Caliph from office? Because they generally did see themselves as part of this broader community. And if you think about it, a more macro level, right? If you look at the intellectual centers of medieval Islam or even early modern Islam, India is absolutely considered to be one of them.
Yeah.
And it's only after independence, only after partition, that India loses its status as a jewel, basically, in this kind of Islamic cosmopolis.
Yeah.
And starts to kind of heavily lean into a very different interpretation of history that emphasizes difference from the peoples around it rather than similarities and connections.
All right. So with that, we're going to call it a day. This has been a fascinating conversation. If there is one thing of all of these complexities that you should take away, is the fact that history is not a binary. It is a mix of really complicated events and a lot of black swan events which nobody could have thought about and predicted. So enjoy the complexity as opposed to fixating on a binary. Thank you so much, Anirudh. Thank you so much, Aditya. And thank you so much for listening.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com. or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.